I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is philosopher, activist, and filmmaker Bernard-Henri Lévy. He's joined in conversation by Robert Rosenthal, and now join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Bernard-Henri Lévy and Robert Rosenthal.
Bernard-Henri Lévy is here with us this evening. Known around the world simply as BHL, he's a philosopher, activist, filmmaker, and author of more than 30 books, including The Genius of Judaism, American Vertigo, Barbarism with a Human Face, and Who Killed Daniel Pearl? His writing has appeared extensively in publications throughout Europe and in the United States. His documentaries include Peshmerga, The Battle of Mosul, The Oath of Tobruk, and Bosna. Lévy is co-founder of the anti-racist group SOS Racisme and has served on diplomatic missions for the French government. His latest book, The Empire and the Five Kings, is a provocative look at America's withdrawal from world leadership and the rising powers who seek to fill the vacuum left behind. Appearing in conversation with BHL after the reading is Robert J. Rosenthal. A journalist with more than 50 years of experience, he's held positions at the New York Times, the Boston Globe, the Philadelphia Inquirer, and the San Francisco Chronicle. He's the former executive director of the Center for Investigative Reporting and now sits on its board. Please join me now in welcoming Bernard-Henri Lévy to the stage.
Thank you, Stephanie. Thank you. Thanks, all of you, for this fine and great meeting. I'm very happy to be back in San Francisco and with the JCC. We are going to start this evening by a short reading, short 20 minutes, of a few pages of my most recent book, The Empire and Five Kings. You have to forgive my pitiful English, my dramatic English, especially for a reading. I think it's a little better without the accent, but alas, I cannot. So I will give you the reading of one of the central parts of the book, central chapter, a piece of one of the central chapters, where I try to depict and to describe the core of the core of the creed of the United States of America. What is the creed of this very special country? What does this sense of chosenness comes from? And as you will see, as you will hear now, my thesis is that there are two seeds of this sense of chosenness. One is in Jerusalem, and the other one is, let's say, between Troy and Roma. But I give you, I start reading. A part of the political, mythological, and symbolic inheritance of the United States of America predisposed it, when the time will come, to an imperial predication, however recalcitrant. And at least two themes in its geopoetical armamentarium were compatible with saving Europe and later assuming the position of a great liberal power ready to defend the values of freedom more or less all over the world. The first was the appeal of Jerusalem. The Pilgrim Fathers, arriving on the far shore of the Atlantic, were determined to be a new chosen people in a new promised land. The idea of America was incomprehensible without the millenarian notion of a new land of milk and honey to which one might go and build a Jerusalem on earth without waiting for the end of days, skipping the steps set out in the Old Testament and the Gospels. And that was the meaning of the famous exceptionalism formulated by John Winthrop in the spring of 1630 during the voyage that took him from the old world to the new. We have a special pact with the Lord, Winthrop told his flock. We will be a model of charity and Christian virtue. We will be the city upon a hill proclaimed in Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. Of course, it is possible to give an isolationist reading to this heresy upon which the United States was built. Is not the main purpose of manifest destiny to manifest itself? Is not the first job of a city on a hill to be seen, simply seen, visible and offered up for the admiration of the nations of the world? And is it not enough for a new Jerusalem to be a jewel, blazing with a thousand fires, dazzling the world with its incandescent beauty? But there is another possible reading to give to this credo. In the actual history of the sects and churches that made up the United States of America, no less strong than this first reading has been, the temptation to encourage the world to move from admiration to adhesion, from amazement to imitation, and when the movement was not rapid enough, when distant lands were slow to adopt the canons of the sublime city, to give them a little shove in the right direction. To put it plainly, I think that Woodrow Wilson's decision to go to war against Germany in 1917, FDR's resolution to join the battle against fascism in 1941, and moving into caricatural mode, John W. Bush's contoured and ill-fated operation to bring down Saddam Hussein's dictatorship in Iraq, all drew from the same well. The paradigm was always the same, a belief in the exceptional role of an American nation called upon to pick up the torch that had fallen from the fragile hands of the prophets and the apostles of the city of God, and the mission was to carry that torch into dark lands. But the second theme is the Virgilian dream. Why Virgilian? Because Virgil is the poet who in the Aeneid recounts how Rome was founded by a survivor of the burning city of Troy. Because it is he, Virgil, who told us that the colossal Roman Empire had its origin in the Odyssey of a single man, Aeneas, who took off with the guardian deities of defeated Troy and arrived several years and several seas later in the Terra Incognita of Italy, and because that was the other idea lodged in the heads of the first pioneers when they set off for America, to flee Amsterdam, Paris, London, Plymouth, those new Troys consumed by the fire of persecution and tyranny, to take a moment before boarding the boat to capture the flickering flames of the guardian deities of the cities of Europe. Those deities being the spirit of tolerance, a predilection for the common good and for law, the idea of freedom, and at the end of a long and exhausting voyage during which they too were the playthings of higher powers, were led to gates of hell, and were tempted 1,000 times to fall into discouragement and to give up, those pioneers found, as Aeneas and his companions has found on the shore of Latium, a virgin soil on which to release their deities, divinities whom they had washed in the deep waters of the new Mediterranean, that was the Atlantic Ocean. We know that Thomas Jefferson was a fervent reader of Virgil, and that fidelity to the European origins of his country, of the country he helped to found, was one of the reasons that led him in 1793 to call for active support for the French Revolution in opposition to George Washington. We know that the Aeneid was bedside reading for great Latinists like the Puritan clergyman Cotton Mather, the poet Samuel Lowe, whose ode lauded the ratification of the U.S. Constitution, the group of Boston citizens who urged the King of England to adopt a better pastoral policy, Charles Thompson, designer of the Great Seal of the United States, and much later the journalist John O'Sullivan, opponent of death penalty, precocious feminist and inventor in sympathy with the best of Italic and European heritage of the very concept of manifest destiny. One just has to inspect the dollar bill which you have in your pocket, maybe, to find not just one, but three quotations from Virgil. First, on the back, at left, circling the truncated pyramid capped with the eye of Providence and subtitled in Roman numerals with the date of the Declaration of Independence, are the words, Novus Ordo Seclorum, taken from the Bucolics of Virgil. These words announce, in Latin, a new order of the age. Above that, you will find Anuit Coeptis, which means, please favor our undertakings. And this is a free adaptation of a verse from the Georgique of the same Virgil, in which the poet implores the divinity not to abandon him. And finally, at right, held in the beak of the eagle, that was also a symbol of Rome, we have a banner with the famous phrase E pluribus unum, that also appears on the Great Seal, which conveys patriotic unity from a plurality of origins. E pluribus unum is again an adaptation of a verse of Virgil. The mission of these early Americans is clear. It is to express, extend, and expand upon Virgil and the Aeneid. It is to prolong still farther west the great adventure that began in Troy and continued with the founding of Rome before finding its provisional fulfillment on the shores of New England. The references, not just to Latin, but specifically to Virgil's Latin, signify an unbreakable tie to Europe as a land of ruins, both moral and material, a land that one has left behind without regret, while feeling certain of having saved the best part, and firmly intending to bring it back to life exactly as Aeneas did. And the nostalgia for Europe, the regret converted into resolution, the metaphysical decision to replay the invention of Europe, to replay the invention of Europe, is the second well from which the descendants of the Pilgrims and the Puritans drew in 1917 and again in 1941 when they retraced their steps, made the founding trip in reverse, and undertook to save the continent when they had come. A strict reader of the Bible will not fail to observe that it is not easy to be faithful simultaneously to Jerusalem and to Rome. And such a writer might even point out that the holy city, the new Jerusalem, come down from God out of heaven, is the opposite, term for term, of the blood-drunk war from Revelation, whose name is Babylon, which is another name for Edom, and thus for Rome, and thus for Europe. But be that as it may, America, when she embarks on imperial predication, even half-heartedly, is Jerusalem plus Rome. Generous America, friend of democracy abroad as well as at home, is Isaiah plus Virgil. It was necessary to combine these two reasons so that the American dream could present itself as a dream for all, one with universal pretensions, even if this was only half true. And then I come to America of today.
Good evening, and I'm Robert Rosenthal. So what we're going to talk about tonight is this. The book is far-ranging and covers a lot of really interesting topics, as well as you just heard. But the underlining theme of the book really is the collapse or the weakening or the shift in American leadership in the world and the values of America that stand for freedom, tolerance, and democracy. And the reference to the five kings, there's five nations you write about: China, Russia, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and Iran, and their leaders. And the impetus for the book, or the motivation, I guess, you say very clearly, is that the quote, the justice of the fight. And the fight here was really the fight of the Kurds. And your experience going to Kirkuk in Kurdistan, I think beginning in 2015, through what happened with what you call, and I clearly see as a betrayal. So can you describe and begin talking about the analogy, really, the role of the U.S. in that and what you saw and witnessed, and the role of the five kings? And I want to also say something that this is a... You know, you're hard to categorize in any one way, I think, but I really want to honor your, what I call, going to the story, because even at this point of your life, you take great risk and you go to the story. You want to be a witness. And the power of your storytelling that comes through is not only the witnessing you've seen, but also some of the people you've met along the journey.
You're listening to philosopher Bernard-Henri Lévy, whose new book is The Empire and the Five Kings, America's Abdication and the Fate of the World. He's joined in conversation by Robert Rosenthal on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Can you take us to the moment of 2017 and maybe explain what was happening from you, what you're trying to say in this book about the five kings, those five nations, and the American Empire, or the Western Empire?
Thank you, Robert. Yes, a few remarks. First of all, true that I am an intellectual, a philosopher, whatever, a writer, who is also a witness. And the book starts, by the way, with an opposition with two Greek thinkers or two Greek historians, Timae and Polybe. Very classical opposition for the French and the Americans who did Greco-Latin studies between the sitting historian who just deals with archives, like Timaeus, and the historian who relates the history, but by participating in the events also, like Polybe. Polybe, P-O-L-Y-B-E, Polybius, who was also the great theoretician of the series of regime, tyranny, aristocracy, democracia, demagogia, and so on. So I am on the party of Polybius more than of Timaeus. I am on the party of those who believe that there is an additional value when you can be an eyewitness of what you make the theory of, better than being only a theoretician. I did that each time I could in my long life now, and this book, it is the case. This book is a book of philosophy. It is a book of reflection about the current state of affairs, of the world in which we are entering, but it is therefore fed by many sources of knowledge and so on. But at the start, the first spark of the start happened on the ground, on the battlefield, when I was with my Kurdish friends and when I saw the abandonment and even the betrayal of those Kurdish fighters by the US and by Europe. And this is a first-hand testimony. The book starts with that. And it is with this experience that there is, that happens the lightning, the stroke, the whatever you want, the lightning, that gives me the push and the establishing shot for the whole of the book. Number two, the five kings. The very formulation of the title, I'm speaking here in the JCC, among an audience of, devoted Jews. So, for sure, this rings a bell for any Jewish ear, the five kings. You know, as well as me, that there is in the Torah and then in the Talmud two stories of a war between one empire and five kings. Two different stories. There is one which is very well known, very well, a lot commented, which is a war between the armies of, in the book of Joshua, the armies of Israel against the five kings of evil, the Canaan, the five kings of the Canaan area, which ends in an extermination of the five kings. And there is the first one, much more strange, which involves Abraham himself, which is a war of the empire of the time, a sort of pre-Edom, and five kings. And this is in this first story, which happens in Genesis, I think, 15. It is much more complicated because what is happening, what is ordered, what is demanded to Abraham is not to eradicate the five kings and their kingdoms, but to save them. So the book stands in between these two biblical stories and the two series of Talmudic commentaries that came from them. But of course, it's a book about today. About today, it means that the empire is not Edom, is not whatever. It is United States of America, considered as the reset, the restart, the resuming of the European dream, and the five kings. They are not Sodom, Gomorrah, and the three others. They are the five which Robert just mentioned. Five new, modern, active, authoritarian states who have two targets today, three. Number one, to reduce in slavery as much as they can their own citizens. Number two, to defy the values of democracy, open society, and liberalism that are cherished in this part of the world. And number three, to fill the vacuum left by America in the process of its recession. To recede, as you know, and your administration should know better, to recede, a recession has two meanings in English. It is a geopolitical move when you recede, when you step back, and it has also the meaning that it had in 1929 and the following years, that it had in 2008 with the great financial crisis. Recession is also an economic, a big crisis. So there is today the start of a Western recession, which is geopolitical, but my thesis is that if it continues, it will be also economical. And the five kings have as a common property, as a common will, to fill the space left empty by us.
So the movement, do you believe this movement of the receding of the West or the abdication of the American role began before Trump became president, or is it something that he's just thrown fuel on the fire and it's accelerated so much? And, you know, and then go back to 2017 when you were in Erbil and Kirkuk. I mean, what you actually saw happening on the ground and the betrayal, which I think you believe was a direct reflection of the current administration and the vacuum that was filled, and the ability, the fact that the Americans backed away created the opportunity for the five nations.
What I saw during this circumstance you are evoking is much more than a bad policy of a bad administration. It is much more. And to make it clear in a few words, I would say the following. Your two last presidents, Donald Trump and Barack Obama, everything is different between them. Everything. There is one of them with whom you would love to have a dinner party. The other one, you would be much more hesitating. But there is one thing that they have in common. One thing. Maybe it is the only one. Surely it is. They oppose on every possible matters. On the social health care, on the domestic politics, on the treatment of poverty, on the behavior. On one point, they agree. Probably. I don't know Donald Trump. I know Barack Obama. I spoke at length with him before, years before he came into office. I had this privilege. They have one thing in common. They don't believe in all what I said when I was standing here. They don't believe in the sense of chosenness, which for the founders of America and for those who are faithful to them is at the core of the program of this country. They have in common the idea that America may be a huge country or not so huge, maybe a country for the good or not, but that it is just a country. That all these topics, exceptionalism, manifest destiny, the shining city upon the hill, the new Jerusalem, the reinvention of Roma, therefore of Troy, that all of this is past. This is the common point between the two presidents. One I know personally, the other one I know, alas, because we see him every single day in our Twitter thread and our TV and so on. And my belief is that it is even bigger, this phenomenon, this this movement of withdrawing from these creeds, which I was describing, is a phenomenon which did not started with neither of them. It started before. It is a metaphysical process. It is a big philosophical shift which happens in the depth of the depth of the American, of the rocks on which America is built. It's a deep movement. And what I felt when I was on the battlefield, on the ground, in Kirkuk, Kurdistan, when I saw the amazement, the disappointment, the despair of the Kurds when they felt abandoned by their allies, American allies. When I saw in front of them with my eyes the Iranian tanks proceeding, the Turks advancing, the Putin strategy making the whole new chessboard, and so on, what I saw, the very strange feeling I had was the following. It was not only the fact that a bad administration lacked courage or lacked faithfulness or gratitude toward allies. I had the feeling that five new powers, the five kings, re-embodiment of the kings, of the bad kings of the Bible, were acting, were moving, were deploying themselves in front of me and of my eyes as if America no longer existed. They were moving. This was the my big surprise, and my I was frozen with fear in a way. I felt that these five kings, for the first time in my life, were acting as if they were moving in a pre-Christopher Columbus world. Erdogan, Putin, the mullahs of Iran, Xi Jinping, and the financial, intellectual, spiritual leaders of the radical Islamism today, they act as if they were living in a world pre-1492. It's not exactly like this, of course, but this is the political, if you want, philosophical, whatever impression I had, and it is not only the impression, but it is the shock that my Kurdish friends on the front line, on the barricades, that since 3 years made a defense line against ISIS, had.
And as a historian and a philosopher, it's like the tide is going out on it, and others are taking advantage of this vacuum. But also, an analogous period, you could argue, would be the 1930s, when the American First movement, the rise of what was happening, nationalism, national socialism, fascism in Europe. I mean, this period, history obviously repeats itself many times. I mean, do you see this happening again now? And the rise of the right, the rise of anti-Semitism, is that all a reflection of the American ebbing? And as a nation, do you think the American people are really aware this is happening?
Are they aware? I hope so. I hope so, because it's a real event. The rise of populism, the tide, you say, une marée, a tide, the tide of anti-Semitism all over the world and all over the Western world is honestly an impressive phenomenon. I am 70 years old. I am on the stage since half a century. I never saw that. I never saw that in my country. I never saw that in Europe. And I never saw that in America. I was 2 or 3 years ago in San Francisco, here, in the University of San Francisco, speaking about French literature, maybe. I don't know what was the topic. In the university, in a big amphitheater, in front of hundreds of students of your bright and lovable city. Most of them came to exchange, to hear what I had to say, but a bunch of them, maybe 50, 100, came because they are members, they are activist of a movement which you know, which is a movement for BDS, boycott, disinvestment, sanctions against Israel. I knew before that BDS existed. It exists in France. I knew that it existed in America. But I had in this great liberal city of San Francisco, I had to learn that it had this BDS campaign, this fierce, savage, violent tonality of anti-Semitic, pure anti-Semitic hatred in America. In the very safe haven for all Jews of the world, there is two safe havens for the Jews, Israel and America. In this part, in here, in San Francisco, in the whole West Coast, because after that, of course, I studied this BDS movement. I knew the stories of these Israeli vessels prevented from coasting, from delivering their goods in any harbor of the West Coast, trying to go like ghost vessels from San Francisco to Los Angeles to Seattle and then going to Vancouver. And even sometimes they could not, they had to go back. I don't know where. So this anti-Semitic tide, this anti-Semitic wave, there is no part of the West which is spared by it, including your country. And you have also in America, my theory in this book in particular, is that anti-Semitism today has three engines. Or three pillars. It depends if you want to have a mechanical way of it or an architectural conception of it. One is anti-Zionism. The second one is the denial of Holocaust. And the third one is the competition in victimhood. Okay? Anti-Zionism. Jews deserve to be hated because they are friends with the fascist states. Denial of Holocaust. Jews are crooks who, in order to create a sorrow in the rest of the world, invented or exaggerated the reality of the Holocaust. And competition of victimhoods, because we hate Jews all the more, because by overestimating or even overstressing, even if it is true, their own suffering, they overshadow others' sufferings. These are the three theses of an anti-Semite of today.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is philosopher Bernard-Henri Lévy, whose new book is The Empire and the Five Kings, America's Abdication and the Fate of the World. He's joined in conversation by Robert Rosenthal. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So, populism is on the rise. Anti-Semitism is a real tide. America first. I don't know to which extent your president is aware of it. Is, as you all know, was a fascist slogan popularized in particular by the aviator Lindbergh before 1940, in the time of the neutrality of America, blah, blah, blah. You know all of that. So you, therefore we, because I feel as an American by heart, I am an American patriot in my way, like Marquis de Lafayette and Tocqueville. You have some Frenchmen who are like this. We are in this situation of a west-wide tide of black and dark regression. This is our situation against which we have to fight.
So is there, how do you push back at this? Is there a solution? Is it awareness? And I, you know, the book goes everywhere in a way. We could talk here quite a long time tonight, but and you allude, you know, the nature of the five kings, I'll go back to, especially the Iranians, the Saudi influence, Turkey, in terms of the role and the vision and the view of Israel in the Middle East, you know, this tiny state. And I think the global population of Jews is 0.02%. It's obviously tiny. I mean, how do you tie this together? And is there a way to push back at this that can really be effective? Is it leadership? In the book, you talk about Trump and his language and his symbolism. But, how do we, or how do you go about, how do all of us go about pushing back at this question? And you said earlier, just a minute ago, there is a reason to be frightened. And when you're frightened, what do you do?
First of all, when you are frightened, it's good to be frightened. It's good to be afraid in life and in politics. I fear those who do not fear. I'm afraid of those who are not afraid. And for example, you have in America a president. He was fairly elected with a very strange way of election, but either one you have, till the reform, which I hope will come soon. So I respect him. But if I were a Jew in America, first of all, I would be very careful. You have some kisses in life, and even more in politics, some kisses that are kisses of death. And sure that Donald Trump kisses the Jews and kisses the Prime Minister of Israel and shows some gestures of friendship. But if I were an American, I would be very cautious, much more cautious than seem to be sometimes in France also, in Israel for sure, but also in America, our leadership. So number one, to be cautious. Number two, no recession on our values. Jews are 0.2% of the world population, you said, okay. But they are, their possible participation in what I would call, in a little pompous way, but I'm sorry, I'm a Jew, in the work of redemption, their participation in the work of redemption of the world is much more than 0.2. Their role among the rest of the nations, because to be a Jew, this is my theory also, my deep conviction, to be a Jew is not just to gather between Jews. Is not just to celebrate Shabbat together. To be a Jew means to have a responsibility among the nations. This is to be a Jew. Not for me, but this is to be a Jew according to Moses, according to Maimonides, according to Rashi,
according to the Maharal of Prague, according to all the biggest wise men and women, and not many, to be honest, prophets of our tradition. To be a Jew means to have a responsibility among nations. So my second advice would be not to resignate, not to recede, not to stop, as the Torah says, and as the Talmud elaborates, not to stop, not ever stop, never ever, reading every verse of the Torah as if it had 70 faces. This is to be a Jew, to read every single verse, every single word of every verse, as if it had 70 faces. This is to be a Jew. This is the responsibility of the Jews for the nations and for the world. And if I had a recommendation to do, is despite the dark times in which we are entering, and maybe not only despite, because of the dark times, not to resign on this, not to abandon, not to recede on this vocation.
Thank you. I just wanted to say I'm glad. I was going to read something you wrote, but you summed it up. It's because at the end of the book, you do offer hope, and you offer a solution. And what you're really saying, the solution is in each one of us. You know, one grain of sand can make a difference and change the course of history. I recommend the book. It's very well written, and we barely touched any of the themes, or many of the themes in the book. So if you have questions, I think there's someone who's going to run a mic. Here's somebody with their hand up.
Okay. My name is Nienke Hohrmann. I'm not Jewish. I'm Dutch. But my father liberated hundreds of Jewish people during the war. And yes, I know you're a philosopher, but I like to hear you in a more practical way. Like, say, what do people like us who are not Jewish, how can we do anything? We are not going to read the verses of the Torah. I mean,
first of all, I don't know who you are, but if you are a Catholic, a Protestant, a neo-evangelical Christian, I don't know, you read the Torah too. You read also the Torah. If you are a Christian, as far as I know, you read the Torah. The Torah is the common book of all those who are faithful to the book. So, and a Jew says that anyone who read the Torah in a certain way is in a way a Jew or a brother. We are brothers in that. What you can do, you can help the Jews to fight anti-Semitism, because you know that the target of anti-Semitism is not only them, but is also you at the end of the day. Jews are just the first line. The second line comes very soon. You know, even if you are not a Jew, that when anti-Semitism starts, it means that democracy, liberal values in general, society, open society, are threatened, that it is the beginning of the worst. And in this fight, again, there are two camps. And today, the Jews, most of the Christians, and most of the even non-Christian enlightened and the democratic and the liberal Muslims are on the same camp, on the same side of the barricades against the populist. Don't need to be a Jew for that. There is a great Jewish thinker who was named Franz Rosenzweig. Franz Rosenzweig, who died at the end of the 1920s, was, by the way, a former Christian, a former Jew, converted to Christian and went back to Judaism. And in a great book that is called The Star, L'Étoile of the Redemption, he said that there is many ways of access to the truth of the being. Judaism is one of them. Christianity, which had been one of his temptations, was another one. The point is to have your path to the being, to the truth, to the decency.
I have a question concerning this new populism that's apparently raging on both sides of the Atlantic right now. So my question concerning this is, when you look at these new social movements, let's call this Make America Great Madness a social movement, and is the anti-Semitism that seems to be inherent within those movements, is that something that just always existed and now it's coming out? Or is it just the usual suspects, I don't know, in France, maybe the Front National voters or whatever, who are like using these movements as vessels to express their anti-Semitism, and they can now do it in the open without having to fear any kind of reprimands?
Anti-Semitism exists since there are Jews. And anti-Semitism will exist till there will be Jews, maybe even after. Even without Jews, I think anti-Semitism would still exist, even if God makes not. But if there was no longer Jews, you would still have some anti-Semitism. And there were some European countries where you had Poles after the Second World War. All Jews were either exterminated or escaped, and you still had a majority of the country who said that we have too many Jews in the country. So anti-Semitism is a plague, is an illness of the spirit which exists whatever we do, number one. Number two, what we can do is not to eradicate it, but we can contain it. Containment. Like America did with communism in the past, to contain. We can contain anti-Semitism with a mix of wisdom, of force, and of pedagogy, education, with a mix of all of that. If we are a mix of, to use a Greek metaphor, a mix of Achilles, of Ulysses, and of, Nestor, the wise man. If you are the three, you cannot eradicate, but you can contain anti-Semitism. What happens today in France is that this contained anti-Semitism is breaking some levees, is breaking some walls, and expressing in open air and taking the form of a social movement. I'm not surprised of that. You need to be really either stupid or completely ignorant not to know that you can have true social movements expressing a true despair and or a true misery and with real demands, and to be an anti-Semitic one. All the history of Europe is full of that. We are facing that, and we have to deal with that. As for myself, I say that you have to be aware that there is, of course, some social problems in France which have to be dealt with, but the movement which for the moment expresses this social uneasiness has a fascist tonality. It's not the first time. It will not be the last time. And you have that also in America. You have some minority movements
you have some identity politics which stem from a real misery, a real genuine sense of inequality, real demands for more social justice, and they have, I don't want to enter to take examples, and it is the end of our conversation, but you know what I'm thinking about, I'm sure. And they can express themselves, express their demands in words that dive in the depth of the worst anti-democratic, anti-liberal, and anti-Semitic prejudices. This is, alas, the paradoxes of history with which we have to deal. And again, to deal with that, we Democrats, we liberals, and sometimes we Jews, but Jews are not the center of the world. We have to deal with that with wisdom and moral strength. Both of them. Wisdom, sometimes rules, good alliances, and moral strength, and faithfulness to ourselves. Because the best weapon the Jews have in front of this tide of nihilism, which is at the end of the day the common name of all the evils which we went through this conversation, in front of that, the Jews have a great weapon, which is the study, which with their buildings of text and of words, which are their temples of words, which are the tradition of reading and of studying, which are the core of their being. And as long, this is really my belief, and all my work is built on this conviction, as long as they are faithful to this devotion to study, to this mission for truth, to this mission for decent study, they are invulnerable, out of reach, and deeply strong, and stronger, this I'm sure, than those who want to destroy them. This is the conviction of my book. I thank you very much.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was philosopher Bernard-Henri Lévy, whose new book is The Empire and the Five Kings, America's Abdication and the Fate of the World. He was joined in conversation by Robert Rosenthal. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espelet, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aidan Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.